In memory of baby Luca, born October 2022, Luca's parents are listeners and supporters of Time to Talk TFMR.
This podcast is supported by ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. ARC is the only UK nationwide charity offering non-directive, individualised information and support to parents who are making decisions around antenatal screening and diagnostic testing. They also provide specialised bereavement care for those who experience termination for medical reasons. For more information or support, please call ARC on 0207 713 7486.
Hello and welcome to Time to Talk TFMR, Termination for Medical Reasons. I'm Hayley and today I'm joined by Susie Heaney. Susie is a midwife and she has a PhD from Queen's University Belfast. She has recently completed research called the Bluebell Study, looking at parents' experiences of termination for fetal anomaly in Ireland and Northern Ireland. So we know the law has recently changed surrounding terminations in both these countries, but how have these changes impacted women and couples going through termination for fetal anomaly? I'll also just say that Susie is the coordinator in Northern Ireland for ARC, Antenatal Results and Choices. So welcome, Susie. It's really lovely to have you here.
Hello. I'm absolutely thrilled to be here, Hayley, and thank you so much for having me.
Yeah. So maybe we start with a little bit of your background. So how did you come to this place, PhD in this?
Yes, okay. So this definitely wasn't in my life plan or my career plan. And I think, you know, with previous studies, I kind of, like a lot of other people with the research classes, were a bit like, oh, not so sure. But I qualified as a midwife in Northern Ireland in 2014 and was practicing. My first post was actually in London. And then I was based in my local hospital. And I always had an interest in bereavement care with midwifery, and I think I undertook a lot of CPD study days just to find out a bit more about, you know, practical memory making or taking photographs for family. So it always was an interest. And then I saw a PhD advertised in Queen's University Belfast around this topic. You know, from the initial protocol at the very start, it changes a lot from that point. And you know, I think what's really important about this study is it has a real personal origins in that my supervisor, Anya, she had a little boy called Malachi. And during her pregnancy, Malachi was diagnosed with Patoi syndrome. And they went through that difficult process of choosing what to do. And they chose to continue with the pregnancy, and Malachi was stillborn at 33 weeks. But I think Anya was acutely aware that if she had chosen a different path, if she had chosen TFMR, she knew that she would have had to travel at that point in terms of the legal landscape in Ireland. And like a lot of women and parents that go through this, who try and make some form of meaning from the experience in whatever way feels right for them, for her, it was to go to research. So she threw herself into research. And then from that kind of developed this project, because it was looking at what happens to these women that do choose the different option of a TFMR. Mm-hmm. What happens? What is their care like? What do they need? So it was really from Anya and Malachi were the origins of it. And I dedicated the work to Malachi because it was, you know, it was him and it wouldn't be here without him. Mm-hmm. And so I came in, I saw it advertised and I just was really curious. I thought, you know, what does happen for these women and families? And I think I was really attracted to it because it was so practically, it was applied, it was healthcare focused. It was looking at the healthcare experiences and needs of parents. And I really felt it could make an impact on practice. And when I did apply, you know, it was spring 2019. There was no inkling that the law was going to change in Northern Ireland.
Yeah.
So there had been the repeal the 8th, the previous year, 2018, in the South. And I started in September 2019. And, you know, the following month, abortion was decriminalised in Northern Ireland. And I think it would have been a very different project had that not happened. Mm. So that's where it kind of came from. And here we are 3.5 years later and a lot more grey hairs. And
yeah, I mean, it's amazing that you came to it from that angle of seeing it as a proposed research project. I think it's amazing that your supervisor proposed it as well, from having the experience of not choosing that route, choosing the other, but just having the awareness of of this other side, I think is quite amazing to know. And yeah, I mean, we've done a few episodes about Ireland and Northern Ireland, not so much actually about Northern Ireland. I think it's been mainly Ireland, but, you know, touched on Northern Ireland within that. And this whole law change, you've just spoke of it there. I think it is quite interesting because it's so recent, what the impact, as I said in this sort of intro, what the impact has been or not been for this group, you know, for people who are potentially needing termination for fetal anomaly. Did you get any sort of, well, yeah, you tell me, did you get any sort of idea of that from the research?
Yeah, I mean, I think what's interesting about the law in Northern Ireland is, you know, unlike the South, where it was the referendum and it came from the voice of the people, and the majority of society voted for this change, and in Northern Ireland, it wasn't. It was from a Westminster government. It wasn't, you know, even from our devolved government. And so that's been,
it's been imposed,
different.
Hasn't it? It's been imposed. Yeah.
But ironically, I think our actual law is better than both the South and England in terms of it is fully decriminalised, which English and Welsh law is not. You know, it's defences to the Offences Against the Person Act, whereas in Northern Ireland now it's completely decriminalised. But I suppose because it has come from Westminster without commissioning and services are still not fully commissioned, so there hasn't been the input, the resources, the attention, you know, it hasn't been fully supported. So it has been a service that is happening and is happening by fantastic healthcare professionals on the ground working out what needs to be done, what parents need, but it hasn't been a thoughtful service from the top, I would say that.
So just explain about commissioning, so the people listening understand what that means. It hasn't been commissioned.
So it's not a funded service. So it hasn't, there's not extra allocation for staff or resources or training or anything that's needed in line with the service. And that's true for TFMR service and also for early medical abortion services as well. But it hasn't been supported by the government, and it's trusts taken it upon themselves to do that.
Yeah. So basically what's happened is because it was not possible in Northern Ireland or Ireland for a long period of time, you didn't have clinicians who could carry out these procedures. You didn't have necessarily facilities to do that within. So just because a law changes, everybody goes, yeah, great, the laws change, but we don't have the facility, we don't have the clinicians with the knowledge, with the training, as you're saying. So there's a lot more work that needs to happen, and it takes time, I guess, is what I'm hearing.
But I would say, you know, I feel there is a real openness and keenness from the healthcare professionals that I'm speaking to here, that they really want to provide a good service for parents and they want to learn. And it's kind of what's driving me in terms of there is this kind of optimism in terms of moving forward with this. So I do think it is we are moving forward, definitely. And I am excited to where this could go with the staff that are working here. It's great.
Yeah. And so at the university, I mean, they've obviously posted it as the topic for the PhD. I mean, how did they sort of see that, you know, because it was put out when the law was not changed. So,
yeah, I mean, I'm not aware of any issues with it. The original title was exploring those who choose to have a termination following kind of a fetal anomaly diagnosis in countries where it's criminalized or it's recently been criminalized.
Right. Okay.
And I think with research, you know, it's based on curiosity and it's based on trying to find out an answer to something. So I'm not aware of any negativity there was at the start of developing the protocol. I have been met with, you know, Queen's colleagues really positively and warmly. You know, we have to present every year where we're at with our research, and you know, the staff in the School of Nursing and Midwifery have been so supportive and really interested and engaged with it. So it's been great.
I mean, it's really great to hear, because I think, you know, sometimes I wonder if we as in being, you know, a TFMR parent myself, you know, sort of think that there's going to be a lot of judgment. And I'm not saying there isn't judgment, but sort of imagine all this judgment all the time. And I wonder sometimes, is it really like that? Or is it that we don't talk about it freely? So then there's just this assumption that because it's not spoken about freely, then that must mean that there's judgment and therefore shame to be had. But I have heard it. You're not the first person, when we've talked around these sorts of issues, that have said, you know, I was met with warmth and enthusiasm for knowing more, you know, that it was welcomed in a way about, let's have these conversations, or let's find out more about this. So, yeah, so it's really good to hear that.
I will say that I suppose I do think at the start of the project, I was nervous and maybe thought that I would. And it hasn't been until kind of now that I'm coming up to the end that I felt really confident in this area and with what parents said. So that's definitely been a journey for me. And I suppose I totally get what you're saying. And, you know, parents in the study said it as well, about it's very complex, the area of kind of judgment and internalized stigma and perceived judgment. And whenever you're in a state of potentially, you know, sensitivity and maybe looking for it because you think it might be there.
So I've just been thinking about that more recently, about how that actually works. And yeah, exactly what you said, you're sort of in a heightened, especially very soon afterwards, you're in a really heightened state. I mean, it's like being sort of filleted, right? You're just everything. You're just so raw that I think very highly tuned or very sensitive to any potential sense of judgment. And yeah, but it's interesting that actually a lot of times, and this has been my experience as well, that even when I've feared saying something, most people, I don't think I've had anybody say anything really terrible or horrible, or there's maybe been some insensitive stuff, but not necessarily around a judgment of, oh, I don't think you should have done that, you know.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
I think it does come down to, though, and especially with kind of a healthcare focus, is communication. And I think, you know, when we don't speak and we don't communicate, that's what breeds kind of fear and misunderstanding. And I remember, you know, one woman from the study had said that she was being transferred from the labour ward to a different ward. And she felt that the midwives, the staff, were taking her kind of down the back staff lifts and the back corridors to hide her. And she perceived it that they felt negatively about what she was doing, and she perceived it as judgment. And then kind of in the interview, she said in reflection, she's like, I don't know. Or were they trying to give me privacy? Like, I have no, I don't know. But that's what it felt like in that moment.
Yes.
And I just think that could have been totally avoided if we as staff had communicated, would you like to go in this lift? This is why. Or would you prefer to go this?
Yeah.
You know, communication is the key.
Yeah,
so
no, absolutely. I agree 100%. That's kind of what I was getting at, of that, not talking about the sort of the silence around it. Mm-hmm. And if you can't, you know, it's also about patient-centered care there, isn't it?
Yeah.
You know, just saying, these are the options. What would you like to do?
Exactly.
And I mean, I can remember sort of being confronted with options and sort of just feeling overwhelmed by them at the same time. But actually, you know, I had a good bereavement midwife, and she was very good at, you know, where I could take time to make decisions, I was given that time. And actually, there wasn't anything that was really needed deciding right there and then in those seconds. So I think it's probably quite rare that you have to make decisions quickly. It's only up to you if that is a decision you want to make quickly or not. But yeah, you're right. Communication is pretty key. So
I think as well, sorry, just to add there as well, because there are a lot of potentially decisions to make, and some of them are big. You know, there's a big decision. And that, as you said, should be given as much time as you need with that. Mm-hmm. But there are also lots of little decisions which can be very empowering to be able to make, whether it's, you know, which hat would you like for your baby,
mm-hmm.
the colour of the hat. And I think if you have a staff member. So I don't want to limit by saying midwife, nurse, whoever is the staff member that's with you, and whether they're able to give those in a nice pace that matches what the parents want. So it's not just a list of here are all the decisions and choices that you're going to have to make. Let me know. And let me know what you want for your dinner as well.
Yeah. Oh my God.
If we can pace it and in bite-sized chunks, you know, with parents, mirror what they need with that.
The reason I sort of laughed at the dinner part, because I agree with you completely, but there's been several times where that part has been mentioned on this podcast about, hey, what would you like for your lunch? We've got tuna, we've got egg mayo, and this woman is sitting there going, are you kidding me?
Yeah.
What? You know, but yeah, that has been mentioned several times. It's obviously a thing.
It's a thing. And, you know, I don't want to knock hospital catering, but it's sometimes not a great thing.
Yeah, it's like the least of your, you're definitely not hungry in those moments. I don't know. I don't think so anyway. But anyway, I digress. But that did make me laugh when you said that. So this research, I mean, we're talking around some of the things that the parents have said. So tell me what you found.
Okay, well, so I suppose one of the things you picked up on there about kind of person-centered care, and a huge, huge part of the findings, unsurprisingly, were about, you know, the need for person-centered care. Mm-hmm. And I remember, you know, I submitted a draft of the discussion. It was all about person-centered care and respect and looking at trauma-informed practice as a potential, you know, model to use. And my supervisor, Anya, wrote back going like, this is so simple. And I remember going, I have spent weeks writing, you know, this 10,000 word chapter. And I was like, is it too simple for the analysis or what? She's like, no, it just seems such a simple part of care to treat people with kindness and compassion. So it isn't like it's not a surprising result. But really, I suppose I feel the compassion was the protective feature of their care, that the parents were able to make sense of the journey, kind of process it if they had healthcare professionals that were caring for them, that were kind and compassionate and communicated effectively and took that time to work out what did they need at those points. And I will forever say compassion should be at the core of our care. And that was, you know, the biggest finding from what parents wanted and needed from their healthcare experience through this.
And did you have many people saying we had great compassionate care and you had lots of those people, or did you have lots of people saying we didn't have compassionate care? Basically, were you able to sort of see the difference?
Yes. Yeah. So it was, and I suppose that's, you know, the interesting with it, you can break it up in that everybody's experience was so different. It was so unique. And even, you know, the issues with the pre-law change and the post-law change, and within the health system in the north and the health system in the south, it's all a little bit different. But that common theme of those that had compassionate care appeared to be, they reported a more positive experience when they reflected back on it. They were more resolved with that experience and where they were now. Whereas those that did not have that, if they had a lack of compassion, where they perceived any judgment or unkindness, that it kind of had a more profound negative impact. And there were examples of admission to a mental health hospital after, reliance on medication, prescription medication after, and that they were from that group. And it was coming back to that kind of compassionate care from professionals that they didn't feel nurtured, they didn't feel that this loss was acknowledged, was a huge, huge thing. And I will shout about that to any healthcare professional that will listen.
Okay. And so was there, so you mentioned it there about the pre and the post law change. Could you see a difference in there? Was there any impact compassionate wise? So I'm curious about, was there more compassion post-law change versus pre-law change? Or is that something you didn't aggregate?
Well, I suppose it's a little bit complex in a sense. So pre-law change, and they weren't able to access TFMR care at home.
Yeah.
There was this huge sense of abandonment. And, you know, once they'd made the decision, then their days were filled with making practical arrangements and matching ferries and appointments and how do we carry our baby's body home? And a lot say, you know, that really compounded the grief in that that should have been time they were grieving, finding out ways to say goodbye, and it was taken up with that period. However, a lot of those families that did travel to England commented on the compassionate care they received in the hospital in England. They said they were so thankful to receive care and a service that was experienced and established, and the compassion they showed us, we didn't get that at home. They treated our baby respectfully. And then I suppose the other part is, so those that did have an experience post-law change, especially in the north of Ireland and Northern Ireland, were extremely positive about their experience. And I think, as I said at the start, it, it does seem that it's fallen to a small team within Trust that provide this, this care, that are experiencing it. But the feedback has been really positive. The South was a little bit more complicated in the sense that there were people that took part in the study that were post-law change, but some of them were able to receive care at home. And due to their legal situation that two doctors have to believe the baby will die within 28 days of birth, they still had women traveling post-law change. And that was a very complex group, that little minor group of kind of not feel enough and just falling between the cracks of this really grey area in the law. And that was challenging. But I still think within their experiences, whenever they spoke about compassionate care, it was a positive part of the journey. So I definitely think that, but it, it was more complicated with everything else that was going on.
Yeah, I mean, I'm hearing the complication. I mean, you've just uttered a phrase there that we've had heard before, especially when speaking to our friends Jen and Claire at TFMR Ireland, that not fatal enough.
Yes.
This is something I've heard primarily from Irish women, you know, talking about this idea of not fatal enough, falling through the cracks in that way, and how that adds to the complexity, it adds to the trauma experience. As you said, your mind is taken up with all this other stuff that really what you should be focusing on is your baby and your grief and your family. And you can't, because you're thrown into this sort of black hole, really.
Yeah. And I will say for that other group, it was quite complex as well. As you know, several of them said, we feel lucky. And they said, I don't feel like this should be in our vocabulary that we say we feel lucky, but we feel lucky that our anomaly met the criteria for Ireland and we could be cared for at home.
Yeah. I mean, lucky, maybe it's more like relief. You know, it's the sort of relief that I don't have to go to another country. I don't have to leave my home. And, you know, there is relief in that. And that's totally understandable, you know, when this terrible thing happens. I mean, I remember the fear. I was terrified, absolutely terrified. And if somebody had then said to me, I've written about this before as well, that I just kind of took it for granted that, you know, if we decided that termination was the right thing for us, I took it for granted that that would be available. It didn't even occur to me that I might have to fight for it or go to another country, because I wouldn't have had to, you know. So it definitely, I can see how it adds a completely different dimension to the experience. It adds another layer that needs to be worked through, really.
Yeah. And I suppose with that, and, you know, we might come on to it further, is with that layer of going to another country, that you're coming from a culture that doesn't provide that care. So actually there's very little support in the community for it. And, you know, we know with grief and loss that we turn to our closest people, our friends, our family, our community to support us. And for this group of people, they don't have that. So I know there's Lana McCree in the South and TFMR Ireland, but in the North, there hasn't been anything. There's been other pregnancy loss groups, but parents have said they feel quite uncomfortable. They're not sure if they can share. And some would say they might go to a group, but say a different reason how their baby died.
Yeah.
So I suppose I am so honoured and grateful that this post with ARC came up when it did. So it was advertised last summer, just as I was finishing up the writing. And I suppose I see it as the coordinator in Northern Ireland, you know, really taking forward what the parents said they needed in terms of parental support and to connect with other parents and that shared lived experience. So we hosted our first event in December and we have another one planned. And, you know, the feedback for that was, this is the first time I've been in a shared space where I haven't been scared. You know, I feel I can talk about my baby without being scared about judgment. And as we said at the start, whether that's perceived or actual, it's great to have this space because it is so needed.
I mean, again, the word relief comes to mind. You know, I've walked into spaces like that where you just, okay, everybody here, we've all experienced this, not this exact same experience for the exact same feel anomaly, for example, but we have made this impossible decision. And the relief of just going, I know I don't have to explain anything, you know, you just understand. So relief is a big thing. And I am curious. So we were talking about compassion. We're talking about compassionate healthcare. And it did get me thinking about, okay, yes, but what about afterwards? And that's what you're touching on now is, yeah. And then what happens afterwards in the community or in families?
So there is a huge gap, I will say, in terms of formal aftercare. And that came up about parents. And I think this has maybe been discussed before in the podcast about, you know, you have so many appointments. Hypothetically, there's an anomaly found on the 20-week scan because in Northern Ireland, we don't have combined screening at the start of pregnancy. So most parents in the study, it was around the anomaly scan at 20 weeks. But anomaly is found then, and then you have, you're referred to fetal medicine unit or fetal cardiology, and you have lots and lots of appointments. You have your labor and birth, and then you leave hospital and there's nothing.
Yeah.
And there's no communication with healthcare staff. And, you know, that's the point that you need. Well, I think you do need formal aftercare, but in terms of friends and family support. And from the study, that was very mixed. So some said absolutely fabulous friends and family, and they really felt that they went through this journey with them because it ripples and it affects grandparents and aunties and other family members. Where others had examples of no communication or kind of relationships ended as a result of this. So I know one woman said that she told two friends and she said one was great and the other hasn't spoken to her ever again. And she said that then made her go, who can I tell? Like, I don't know who I can trust. These were my friends. So she said then at that point she decided, I won't tell anybody because...
Yeah. I mean, it's heartbreaking. It's really heartbreaking because, I mean... To have to hold this all in, it's just going to make you burst, really. Yeah. I mean, something is...
Your body holds it, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, your body will hold it and you know, hold it to a point, right?
Exactly.
Something's got to give. This is not... Yeah, we're not meant to just take this kind of trauma and absorb it without repercussions.
Exactly.
You know, so yeah, that really breaks my heart hearing that.
Yeah. And I suppose for me as well, it was, you know, I had anticipated for this topic that recruitment to the study would be quite difficult given the topic. You know, I didn't have any experience. I haven't done a master's. It was kind of straight from undergrad to PhD. So I didn't have a huge experience in research. And I was really blown away by every parent that took part said they wanted to do this to talk about their baby and their story, to say their truth and not feel restricted in that. So to be able to share their baby story and to talk about their baby and their baby's name. And then the second reason was to help other families, to help other parents come in behind them if their experience could help in any way. So I was just, you know, blown away by their selflessness.
Yeah. And you know what? I'm not that surprised because of now doing the podcast for this length of time. And it reminds me of another paper that I've read. It's a Danish paper looking at this as well. Similar type of topic, looking at the experiences of. And what came out was that parents saying, this is kind of the first chance I've really had to be able to speak so openly. And I'd say that, again, I think from personal experience, I mean, people don't ask me very much about my experience. And then I'm thinking, I'm hesitating because I'm like, would I want to be talking about it? It depends on the context. Again, mm-hmm. I think in a research context, you go, this is what I'm here for, right? And this is what I want to do. And it's going to help somebody else. Yeah. I mean, that's my experience of this group, that very, very courageous and selfless in that way. And you did speak to both parents, didn't you? Mums and dads, or mums and partner?
Yes. Yeah. So there were 33 parents that took part altogether, mm-hmm. 23 women and 10 partners. So it's reflective of other research that it's a difficult group to reach, is the partners.
Yes.
And I know there's work going on at the minute on a research study that's just looking at partners, which I think is fantastic.
Yeah.
Because I will say that I do think it is a limitation of my research, in the sense that there were 10 partners, but 6 took part in a dyad interview or a mm-hmm. couple interview, and that almost answered as a couple. So I don't feel I really got into kind of the depths of the partner experience.
Yeah. Well, we've done one so far. We've done one episode with a dad on his own. And we also interviewed his partner, his wife, but separately. And it was really quite something else, really, to have him just expressing on his own. And we're actually going to do, we put a podcast call out for dads. I wanted to focus on men specifically. And I was expecting to be pulling teeth, and actually we've had a really good response. And so we're going to do a little series instead of just one episode. We're going to do it as a panel as well, because so it won't be individual, but it will be panels. And so it'd be 2 or 3 dads together talking about their experiences, thoughts, That's feelings, brilliant. Emotions around it. Because I think it is really, as you said, you know, it's under research. I mean, the whole topic is under researched. And then, you know, you take this bit and it's even more so. So, really interesting. And did you, when you were interviewing both, could you see the differences in experience? Was there how they were impacted?
As I say, I do feel that the dyad interviews were more kind of as a couple whole focused, and maybe more on the experience of the woman, and the part, there was a more minor part of the kind of the partner's feelings with that. With the individual partners, I felt it got a lot deeper into how they, when they were given that space to say how they feel, and the questions were directly to them and not how they maybe perceived it to their partner first and then secondary. So I think it's really,
which is also powerful. That's interesting, isn't it? When they're together, they just assume this question is for my wife, girlfriend, whatever, to answer, and I've got the minor role here. That's why I want to interview dads first, because I'm interested in the male perspective here.
Definitely. And what research is out there is that, you know, partners feel quite conflicted between those roles of the main support person for their partners. So but also, where is that grieving father, that loss and that shock, but not wanting to upset their partner more. And they deal with it very differently.
Interesting.
Work.
Interesting. So I guess, you know, we've talked about sort of compassionate care and communication being really at the heart of that, and the sort of ongoing after experience of, you know, after you've been through this horrendous experience and then you come out of the sort of healthcare setting. And I think what I heard you mention in there is that is there no healthcare part to this after? So is there any aftercare in a healthcare setting for these parents, or is it quite hit or miss?
So it's different to those. So we have bereavement midwives in every trust, which are fantastic. They are not a counselling service. So, you know, some trusts are able to signpost to counselling, or I know one does offer counselling. And usually there's an appointment with a consultant maybe 12-ish weeks after. But I think a lot of parents commented on that very kind of initial period. That they maybe got a call from a community midwife, but they didn't go out. So, you know, some parents reported that they felt.
Why wouldn't they go out?
So do you, what some parents described as like, do you want me to come out, or I'm just checking in that you're okay?
You know what? If you're grieving and you've been through this and you are kind of thinking any sort of, there's any sort of sense of guilt or regret or, you know, feeling, should I even be grieving or any of this stuff? If somebody goes, do you want me to come out? You're going to say no. No, yeah. No, don't worry
about
it.
So, I mean, that's what they said. I'm fine. Yeah.
Yeah.
It should not be an opt-in service. It should just be, this is what happens. But parents did with that, and I suppose they got a bit confused with or torn that they felt now that there wasn't a baby, mm-hmm. the woman didn't matter. So some women did have physical complications in terms of bleeding, or they were worried about that, but they still just felt there wasn't the proactive care that they potentially would have had if there was a baby at home. So I think that's a real area that needs looked at. I would love, you know, if I had the government money, I know there's none there, but, you know, in terms of bereavement community support.
Yeah. I mean, I think I know here, I mean, my experience, I was very, very lucky with my bereavement midwife that, you know, she came to visit me at least once a week at the house. It may have even been more than once a week in those first few weeks and then tapered to once a week, you know, and that went on for a long, long time. And I seem to remember she said to me, now I can do your, you know, the sort of home visit community midwife thing,
yeah.
or we can have the community midwife come out and do that. And I believe I just said to her, well, if you're happy to do it, I'm happy to stick with you rather than having somebody else come in. But you know, the idea that, oh, well, if there's no baby to visit, we don't need to come out. What? I mean, is that the same? You might not know, but is that the same if somebody's had a stillbirth or a late miscarriage, or they just sort of leave women?
I'm not entirely sure. So I don't know if there is a policy of that you need. I think the community midwives do check in, but I don't know if it's, they say it's a case by case basis, whether they go out.
Yeah, because I mean, whatever the reason for this baby loss, for this pregnancy loss, you may still need actual physical care, let alone the emotional care, but the physical care, you know. And I caught there that most of these women will be experiencing a second or third trimester loss then, because if most of these are not being caught until the 20-week anomaly scan, I imagine quite a lot of women are pushed into the third trimester.
Yeah, but I do think there's some confusion as well, you know, especially here in the sense of, because we don't have a clear pathway or guideline of who, I think there might be some assumptions of other people are doing stuff. Mm. And I think that's a big thing with this experience as well, is increasing understanding across the kind of spectrum of care, because I think people see a very small part of it. So fetal medicine see their part and then they don't see what happens, you know, sonography, and it's quite disjointed. And I think we need more understanding of the entire experience and who's doing what. And, you know, you said something there, and I do think continuity of care could solve a lot of issues in terms of what parents say they want, in terms of, you know, that they trust the healthcare professional, they feel safe, you know, compassionate and non-judgmental care, their experience in the field. So I think continuity could do that, and ensuring that pathways and referrals are made. Whereas at the minute, I feel, because it's quite disjointed and we don't know exactly who's doing what. So I don't want to, you know, knock community midwives that they're not supporting bereaved families at all.
Yeah. And I think, you know, I very much take this as, this isn't the individual community midwife. Yeah. This is a system problem, not them on the individual personal level. Yeah. So I'd want to make that very clear as well. I see that that is the issue. Okay, so where do you see this research impacting the system that we're talking about? Is it being taken up? How is it being sort of
received? So I should also say, you know, as part of the Bluebell study, I had interviews and narrative accounts with parents, but I also involved healthcare professionals in it as well. So I had a the initial plan was just for interviews, but due to COVID and fears of workload and recruitment, I introduced a kind of a short qualitative survey as well. So there were 36 healthcare professionals took part in the survey, and then 10 interviews to kind of get what do they need as well? What do they feel parents' experience are? And is that matching? Is it congruent? Mm-hmm. Which it very much was. And also, what do they need? So there was some huge areas in training and misunderstanding with that. So I suppose from the PhD, I have, with Anya, established a Northern Ireland Pregnancy Loss Research and Policy Network to help disseminate this work and kind of the wider pregnancy loss research and conversations in this area. So kind of key stakeholders in the area were invited. So I presented the findings to that in October. And we actually had a meeting this morning, the second meeting of the network this morning. And Jane Fisher from ARC, the wonderful Jane, presented. And also Dr. Brenda Kelly.
So it was got major girl crush with Dr. Brenda Kelly. Yeah, no, they're great. They're both of them are great. They're just
fabulous.
Like, yeah, so amazing. Yeah.
So really, really, I suppose that's where, you know, I feel really driven because there is such an openness and keenness from staff to learn, and they want to do it well. They want to provide a good service for parents. So, you know, Brenda spoke a lot about aftercare and subsequent pregnancies and her experience here. And it was actually, you know, it was lovely that she's from Northern Ireland. So I think, you know, that there is work going on here. And I suppose through ARC as well, I see a big part of my role is training healthcare professionals. So we have the first training scheduled in a few weeks, and it's full with a waiting list of staff to learn. And I think it is raising awareness about the whole journey and what parents say are important. And I really do feel that staff want to listen.
I mean, that's amazing. Yeah. It's amazing, you know, if the listeners just hearing that the staff want to give you good quality, high quality, compassionate, individualized care. Yeah. They want to do that. And what they need is the training to be able to do that, to have the confidence to do it as well.
And the safe space for conversations. I think a lot of healthcare professionals said that they felt the law took away this kind of dark cloud of we can't talk about anything, and now we can have more open conversations about care.
Do you think that's because of the law change? Is that because we can?
I think some of them feel a lot freer. Yeah, yeah. That they feel a lot freer with conversations, or you know that they maybe would have, you know, directed parents to England before, or you know, for other reasons for abortion, but always felt there was a bit of a where is the line, or you know, where is my registration? Can it be challenged? So there is a kind of a freedom of practice, which is great, that they feel that.
Well, and it just goes to show, you know, the humanity, right? It's the humanity of, I got into this to help people and to, you know, care for them. And by having more freedom now within the law, it's sort of taken a bit of the it's taken the shackles off, you know, being able to kind of explore this a bit more, and how can I give good care to the people that I see. And I mean, I think within this we are saying that there's still room for other changes to happen.
Yes.
You know, yes, some work has been done on the law. Do you think there's any more that needs to be done within the law?
Well, I suppose I'm waiting to see what the commissioning statement is. I think screening will be really the screening pathway, and if as part of this there will be funding for, you know, combined screening.
At the sort of 12-week mark, that's what we're talking about here.
Yes. Yeah. Yes. Because I do think that will change the pathway for parents with, you know, potentially much earlier diagnoses. So I think that would be really, really good to see. And I think, you know, ARC will, you know, campaign for that. And parents, they said, you know, they wanted honest information and they didn't understand that it was, I don't say different to England, but I suppose they were confused because no one was expecting it. No one had really understood the differences in, that you could have had something that, you know, in England, Scotland and Wales, there is a difference to that pathway. So
yeah,
I could have found this out, you know, 10 weeks ago. So I think that's just kind of bringing it in line and making it more equitable, that it shouldn't be a postcode lottery. But I suppose with saying that, I do think Northern Ireland is quite unique in that we are a relatively small region. And, you know, I think unlike England, which is very spread out, we could do this really well together with 5 healthcare trusts. And this could be a really collective, collaborative approach. So I am optimistic for that.
Yeah, that's great. Is there any fear around, you know, in the light of Roe versus Wade, around going backwards? Has there been any kind of...
So there was a challenge to the law. There was a bill brought forward and it was voted down and it would have to go kind of back to the start again. So I suppose, you know, I do think that is sitting there, but I do feel that politicians are listening to medical professionals. I don't think it will. I'm not saying it won't. I don't think it will. I think we are moving forward and I would be quite surprised to see it go backwards. I suppose, you know, there are maybe political parties that want it in line with the South, and, you know, there's beyond my political knowledge about kind of all Ireland and that we would match the South with that. But I don't see that happening.
Yeah, my sense is that there are always little threats, but not necessarily little. I shouldn't maybe necessarily say it, label it as that, but there are always those who oppose, and there are always those that may seek to, you know, pass, get laws across the line and whatnot. And I think I sort of see it as, unfortunately, it means that we can't just sort of go, phew, okay, done that. And we can move on now. No, we're probably always going to have to defend this corner of women's rights. I that's my feeling.
I don't find that we're trying to do, I don't think the healthcare professions here are trying to do the bare minimum of the law. I really do feel they're trying to establish
and an that's the optimistic
service.
Thing
yeah
that's the that's yeah. the really optimistic thing, because if you've got healthcare, and that's what I'm really pleased to hear you saying, is that you've actually got healthcare professionals on board with this. They want to give their patients the best care and the compassionate care. They see what parents go through, and you know, they took the oath to help people, you know. And so that's the really optimistic thing, is you've got, because once you've got that on board, then, as you say, you can start building, then you can get the training in, then you can get the facilities in, and you have the appetite.
And I suppose I am, you know, acutely aware, you know, am I in a bit of an echo chamber in that, you know, I am talking to people that want
the speaking
service.
Speaking to the converted,
And I suppose I am very aware that there are, you know, staff out there that do not necessarily want this, but I feel that there are enough voices driving this forward that I'm positive with that. So, and I haven't received any negativity, you know, so.
No, it's good. It's good to hear. It's really good to hear. I guess we're gonna come towards the end here, but I wanted to ask you, do you have any other more research in the pipeline? Do you think you do, don't you?
Oh yes. Which again I said I would never do.
You gotta stop saying that, because you're clearly jinxing
yourself.
When
I started this, I said I am never going through ethics again. This is no. But so I have a part-time post with ARC, and I have another part-time post continuing work in this area with Queen's as a research fellow.
Yeah.
And we're in the early stages of a project, but it is looking at supporting the mental well-being of parents following a fetal anomaly diagnosis.
Okay, great.
Whether they choose to continue or end the pregnancy. So we're looking at kind of an element of cognitive behavioral narrative therapy. There's a lot of work with journaling. So so we're kind of hashing ideas about it at the minute. So yes, that will continue.
Exciting. Really good. Well, thank you so much. We do something at the end of each episode. We call it the TFMR takeaways. I've kind of tailored it for you. So I wanted to ask you, What was the most impactful piece of information or piece of a story or whatever that really was impactful in this research that you did on you, you know, so in a kind of personal aspect?
I suppose the first thing, and I went down many rabbit holes in this research, and Anya kept having to drag me back out of those rabbit holes. But one of those was about the transformation of the parent. So I went down a rabbit hole of rites of passage. I don't know if you've heard it, Van Gennep's rites of passage, but it was that parents entered this experience and they came out of it totally different people. Mm-hmm. And I suppose, you know, personally, I don't know what I was expecting with that, but I think it was the most profound for me that there was this huge state of messiness in the middle and very embodied kind of shock and trauma. You know, I remember one father said it was like a bomb went off inside his body, in his heart. Mm. And he said, you know, when that happens with a building, all the pieces can kind of move away and shards.
They're talking about fracturing.
Yeah. And he said in his body, it was contained in his body, but that's the pain he felt and he couldn't escape it. So that's really stayed with me, and kind of acknowledging that and giving space for that. I think I definitely developed as a researcher, and I'll say as a midwife as well, by the end with the kind of more later interviews, being a lot more comfortable with that silence and allowing, not trying to make it better, not trying to rush on to the next question, just sitting there with them and hearing them is kind of how I feel I've developed with it, if that answers that question.
Yeah.
And I suppose the second thing I wanted to say was my closest friend went through this just after I finished. And I suppose, you know, 3 years working on a PhD, living and breathing every second of my life, my thoughts in the shower, you know, the kind of PhD was all consuming. I'm a midwife with a background, but it still didn't prepare me for someone so personally to go through it. I would say it was very different. My professional head as a midwife and a PhD researcher, and experiencing it as, you know, a support person to someone I loved dearly. So it's hard for everyone.
Well, thank you, Susie, for sharing that. It's really really great to hear and very inspiring, so I really appreciate you sharing all of that with us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Yeah, and maybe what we can do is in the show notes I can put I don't know if there's like a link to the Northern Ireland group meetings or anything like that on ARC, and then also maybe a link for your research if anybody's interested in reading. But yeah, thank you so much for sharing all of this, really, and sharing you as well.
Well, thank you, and thank you for doing this work. As you know, I said I came across your podcast kind of I think it was before I started data collection, and I just found it such a valuable resource.
Amazing.
So thank you for the work you do, and we're all on the same kind of vision of improving care and experience for parents and families, so thank you.
Yeah, no problem. Thank you so much. It's lovely. Thank you for listening, and we hope you enjoyed it. Don't forget to subscribe to the podcast. This ensures you get all of our new episodes as soon as they're released, and you can find us from most podcasting platforms. Get in touch. We love hearing from you. Find us over on social media, Facebook and Instagram at Time to Talk TFMR and Twitter at Talk TFMR. So that's all for this time. Thank you, and please take gentle care of yourselves.